the magical power that I seem to possess is a willingness to read past the executive summary of very long PDFs and occasionally check the footnotes.
No worries. Thank you.
Thank you indeed. Hello, my name is Ben Beatty and welcome to the Baseload Podcast, episode number 29. Who would have thought I'd stick it out this long? Baseload is still the only Australian podcast taking on the mainstream narrative that a high renewable system can be cheaper than a baseload-dominated system. For regular listeners, thanks for your support. For new listeners, thanks for showing up. I hope you get something out of it. Remember, if you have comments or feedback, the mailbox is always open at thebaseloadpodcast@gmail.com. Yes, I'm too tight to have my own domain name, so Gmail it is. This episode, we have extracts from the recent nuclear and energy planning hearings. We catch up on the panel debate between Simon Holmes Acourt and Aidan Morrison. Chris Bowen gets the goat again, and I interview Chris Uhlman about his excellent documentary, The Real Cost of Net Zero, a program I am thrilled to have had some minor input into. Up front was a fine retort from Aidan Morrison during his appearance at the Select Committee on Nuclear on Monday the 28th of October 2024. Dan Rapaccioli, a Labor MP from the Hunter Valley, had questioned Aidan's qualifications, a Bachelor of Physics, by the way. Aidan's reply about the footnotes was a callback to his sudden entry into the energy debate when he was called out by Simon Holmes Acourt on Twitter for not reading the details of the ISP, AEMO's Integrated System Plan. Aidan took on that challenge, and the results speak for themselves. I'm looking forward to the Australian story version in a couple of decades when we're all old and grey. Before we start on the Parliamentary Select Committee on Nuclear and the Senate Select Committee on Energy Planning and Regulation, my high-level comment on the proceedings is that the renewables lobbyists are hopeless. They're really bad at this. I don't know whether to be pleased they are so bad or disappointed that this is as good as it gets. No wonder Simon Holmes Acourt injects himself into the energy debates if these clowns are running the show. In contrast, those who support nuclear and criticise the current narrative pushed by governments appear stable, calm, they have deep understanding, and they know the details that underpin their comments. They're entirely serious people. Now, you may be tempted to point out my bias, and you'd be right. However, my bias from here in Brisbane does not change what these individuals are saying on the record in Canberra. These people say dumb shit. I can't tell if they believe it or if they just sit around telling each other how great they are in between calling Ted O'Brien and Peter Dutton names. To me, it is obvious they just have not done the work.
The inefficiency, as I understand it, comes from the reliability and the need for planned maintenance, which is not a factor anywhere near to the same degree with wind or with solar. They are generating more often than nuclear can reliably. And this is in particular...
Just to point of clarity, because I'm not sure if I heard you correctly. Did you say wind and solar generate electricity more often? So they run more?
Consistently more consistently and more predictably, as opposed to nuclear, which we've seen in France, where they've had to shut down reactors when there's been drought.
That was Michael Wright, National Secretary of the Electrical Trades Union, trying to convince Ted O'Brien that wind and solar are more reliable and more available than nuclear power. Good luck with that, champ. Sticking with the Select Committee for Anti-Nuclear, let's see what I did there, we come to John Grimes, the head of the Smart Energy Council, the peak renewable energy lobby. This guy knows exactly where his bread is buttered. After all, he does represent the interests of wind, solar, batteries. And who is backing all this stuff? Big corporations, federal and state governments and local councils, mainstream media, the bureaucracies, United Nations, the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization. You get the picture. I find this particular piece of testimony to be distasteful, shall we say.
The Coalition's energy policy is a bit like a dog, circling around and around, finally coming back to eat its own vomit.
These people are not serious. What level of arrogance must you have to say that kind of thing after receiving the privilege of being invited to speak, for your views to be heard, for your opinion to be permanently etched into the record? Here's Grimes with a Dorothy Dixer question from another Labor MP, carefully explaining that baseload is an outdated concept, that electricity demand varies wildly, and in his words, we need to make supply meet demand. But is that what he really means, or was that perhaps a Freudian slip?
Can you explain why baseload is fundamentally not required in Australia's future energy grid?
Oh, fantastic. So baseload power demand fluctuates widely over time. in the middle of the day when industry's working and people, factories are working, demand is relatively high. At 3 a.m, it's almost non-existent. Our energy system of the past, because the technology we had was coal-fired power stations, meant that they can't be turned off. Now, with nuclear energy can be throttled down, but nuclear energy cannot be turned off. It's an inflexible energy source. So you've got demand changing over time. Demand also changes with the weather. Extreme cold, extreme heat. It changes with the seasons. At the moment, we've got plenty of renewable energy and low demand. And so what you need to do is match supply with demand. To stay wedded to a concept of baseload is to actually have an economic inefficiency, to have the cost of generation that does not meet the cost or the market demand. And so what that does is it raises the price of the electricity system for everybody. Baseload power is a 1950s concept that is being utterly debunked. And for the coalition, in their talking points, to hang on to this because it sounds like baseload. You know, those manly man electrons from coal and gas are going to save the day is utter rubbish.
So again, this bloke has utter disdain for the formality of the proceedings and is intent on badmouthing his political opponents. He's been brought in as the representative for the renewables sector to provide his opinions on nuclear power and its suitability for use in Australia. He is not there to express his contempt for politicians or to discuss anybody else's opinions, not unless he gets asked anyway. If you're listening and have tried to engage in good faith with renewables advocates, either on social media or in person or wherever, you'll recognise the strategy in use here, which is to deliberately distract the conversation from the topic in order to avoid answering questions. Because the truth is, these guys cannot answer basic questions. They just can't do it.
Can you please tell me the total system cost of the market operator's plan to get to a net zero electricity grid?
So the really good news is that the Australian energy market operator, the experts who actually run the system, have done detailed costings to answer that precise question.
So we had, Mr. Grimes, we had the operator here last week. They were unable to tell us the real cost from a total system cost perspective under their modelling, which in fact has been confirmed by the Prime Minister in the Parliament as also this government's preferred pathway for a net zero national electricity market.
Mr. O'Brien, you'd need to ask them that question.
So you do not know?
Well, I know what AEMO has publicly released, and that's what I'm aware of.
So do you know if AEMO cannot tell us and you cannot tell us, given your many, many years of experience, which you kindly laid out to us in your opening remarks, can you tell us where we can find that?
Deputy Chair, do you mind if I jump in there?
Please.
Look, the ISP is pretty clear when it talks about 126 or thereabouts build costs. We have no real reason to doubt that. We think it's entirely reasonable. We've gone through the line items in there, and I think it's perfectly logical that that is probably a reasonable ballpark figure.
Last week they confirmed, in fact, that was not the real costs. But thank you for your comments.
Next, Ted O'Brien clearly gets frustrated with the blatant political activist strategy of Grimes and asks Grimes about his funding, a topic clearly uncomfortable for the lobbyist.
Can you confirm if you publish your top 20 largest donors so the public can have transparency as to who pays for your activities?
So, excuse me, Mr. O'Brien, that's not relevant to the inquiry.
Well, I think it is, Chair. I'll tell you why, because Mr. Grimes has just confirmed that it might be relevant on his other disclosure, which is anti-coalition, and given his entire opening remarks were actually highly political about the coalition, I think it is relevant that we ask who is paying for Mr. Grimes to be here.
It's definitely not relevant to the discussion. It's not in our terms of reference. That is not relevant, Deputy Chair.
Our last terms of reference, Chair, includes other issues that might be relevant. And given Mr. Grimes has himself chosen to be very political in his opening remarks, I think it is of interest to the Australian public to know the top 20 donors. Will you be prepared to publish those donors if you have not?
Mr O'Brien, the Smart Energy Council has always and will always follow the law.
Moving on to the Senate hearing on energy regulation and planning, we have Matt Canavan asking what should be a fairly straightforward question of the AER's Claire Savage: which coal-fired power stations buy export fuel? I've left here the extended version so you can all get a feel for yourself of the difficulty Canavan has in getting a straight answer out of the regulator.
You raised the point before that you felt that a material issue was the export coal price. How much is how much of our coal used in electricity power stations is exposed to that price?
So what's more relevant is actually how much is at the margin. So when you look at, for example, Gladstone, or you look at Eraring, those two power stations buy coal that is also used for export. And so when you have power stations that bid at the margin, because we have a marginal electricity price, so it's set based at the margin.
I understand. OK, well, how much of the margin? What's the percentage?
Well, it doesn't matter how much percentage at the margin. If the marginal
coal... you can calculate what percentage of the time...
Well, I can tell you what time...
Because you do calculate that,
yeah.
I know.
Okay, so yeah. If you just give me a moment to open this, I'll answer your question. So, for the last quarter, black and brown coal will have set the price and the marginal generator in the market almost 50% of the time.
And how many of those are exposed to the export market price of that 50%.
So I'd need to go through and look at who
Well,
was the individual
I just worry
plant.
There's a lot of assertions made in this space, like throwaway lines like the export coal price is to blame for high power prices, but it's really only a handful of power stations that are exposed to the coal price in Australia, so I'd be surprised if it's a very large figure. And if you're going to make assertions like that, it's strange there's not the data to back it up.
But
I mean, you mentioned earlier...
The power station that sets the price is the most expensive power station in the system. And so the power stations that have the most...
That's not quite true. Can we just be clear? It's the most expensive power station to meet a certain level of demand.
At that point in time,
Not the most expensive.
But that power station is the most expensive coal-fired power station in the system and the most expensive power station in the system when it's setting price. And the most expensive coal-fired power stations are the ones that are exposed to
this. You're not answering my question, though, and you're not backing up research. You're not, because you've also said, and other things I've seen you say, Mr. Savage, that coal is running at very low utilisation rates. So those power stations are not going to be running when the marginal price is set at all. So they're not going to be in the bidding stack. And so, again, I'll just come back. It's one thing to make an assertion. It's another thing to have the facts and figures behind it to establish it. And you don't have those before us.
No, I do.
So it's a very big statement to make. And it gets reported. Mm. Everybody thinks, it's all coal's fault. But there's nothing behind it.
No, I think... other point, though. Yep. Domestic coal-fired power stations that are not exposed to export markets are generally not the ones setting price.
OK, well, again, I'd love
to see... So I'm happy to take that on notice and come back
that you don't have.
Let's take a minute to unpack what just happened. The senator asked how much coal used for electricity generation is exposed to export prices. A fairly, simple question that maybe the regulator, the chair of the regulator, Claire Savage, might have said, that's a fairly complicated question. Can I respond to it on notice? That would have been fine. But Claire Savage then went on to explain that export coal prices set the price because it's the marginal units that set the price in our dispatch system. She also names Gladstone and Eraring as users of export-priced fuel. Canavan does manage to extract an admission, eventually, that the coal-fired power stations that are not exposed to export prices are not the primary price setters.
Coal-fired power stations that are not exposed to export markets are generally not the ones setting price.
The responses to questions on notice, I'll refrain from calling them answers, are dribbling into the system. If you've registered for updates on a committee, you'll helpfully get an email notification when these updates come in. And the AER's response to the coal question came in on the 20th of November. Here's the first two paragraphs. Most black coal generators are likely to be exposed to the internationally traded price of coal to varying degrees. Some rely on suppliers from mines that trade directly into global markets. Others rely on those mines for spot cargoes when necessary. And all standard coal pricing is set with reference to international indices. This means that there is a clear relationship between international coal prices and wholesale electricity prices. By way of example, black coal generators set the wholesale price of electricity 51% of the time in New South Wales and 55% of the time in Queensland in Q1 2024. Black coal generators that the AER considers are likely to be more exposed to the international price of coal set the wholesale price of electricity 58% of the time that coal was setting the price in New South Wales, and 54% of the time in Queensland in Q1 2024. Apologies for the stupid voice, but I'm not doing it again. Carry on. Focusing on New South Wales Q1 2024, the AER's response states that when black coal set the price, 58% of the time it was generators exposed to export fuel. So the AER knows exactly which generators are exposed to export fuel, and they know exactly the impact of those generators on the average wholesale price.
When you have power stations that bid at the margin, because we have a marginal electricity price, so it's set based at the margin.
I understand. Okay, well, how much of the margin? What's the percentage?
Well, it doesn't matter how much percentage at the margin.
Actually, it does matter how much the percentage is at the margins. Now, maybe she's confusing her terminology, but let's return to the data. If I open up the chart which says AER spot prices, quarterly volume weighted average for the regions, and I go to Q1 2024, New South Wales average spot price for the quarter was $102. But in New South Wales, black coal set the price 54% of the time at an average price of $74, well below the quarterly average. So what are some of the other price setters out there that we didn't get to talk about in the Senate hearings? Gas set the price 7.5% of the time at an average price of $210. Hydro had a much bigger effect on the average price. It set the price 26% of the time at an average price of $139. What about wind and solar? Okay, solar 4.5%, wind 2%. And respectively, minus $360 and minus $368. So almost no effect on the long term, on the average wholesale price in New South Wales. What else is there that could possibly affect the price? Yes, batteries. So batteries, 2.6% of the time. But when they set the price, what are they setting the price at? $314. Oh, like, that's the highest, isn't it?
The power station that sets the price is the most expensive power station in the system.
So out of all those technologies, if you had to choose something which would keep the price relatively low at, say, below $100, you'd have to choose coal. And if coal generated more at that similar average price, the quarterly volume-weighted average price would be lower. So coal is not responsible for very high prices. It is all the other things. And why? And a direct cause of coal not having as much impact on the prices to lower them as you'd expect is because of the market share problem, which is rooftop solar. So I wonder, would somebody dare to calculate what the impact of a coal-fired power stations in New South Wales might be if there was no rooftop solar? Do you think maybe the average wholesale price would be lower without rooftop solar? Because a lower cost generator would fill the market share more often? I wonder. Anyway, one of the favourite questions of the coalition interrogators was AEMO's ISP, the much vaunted Integrated System Plan. Ted O'Brien queried AEMO's head of the ISP, Merrin York, with a question about the total cost. Dare I say it, with predictable results. See if you can catch when Daniel Westerman reels Ms. York back to safety.
What is the real cost? How much money goes out the door, if you like, between now and 2050, according to the ISP step change scenario, not the NPV?
Well, in terms of the capital cost, we also do report that, so I'll just have to look that up in my information, if you just give me a minute.
And just to clarify, while Mary's looking that up, do you mean in nominal terms? The total cost.
Total cost, total system cost, and as you are looking that up, ideally including operational fuel cost, not just capital.
The capital cost, I believe, is $134 billion for the various elements. I might have to take on notice what the operating costs are over that period as well, but they were part of the NPV that we looked at.
So $122 billion on an NPV basis and only $134 billion on
capital
an actual
cost.
I think we'll have to take the question on notice.
We can provide that more detailed breakdown.
It is available on our website, but we'll
come back. If you can, because I've been asking for some time without any luck on that, and I'm surprised that, candidly, the market operator cannot tell us the total system cost of the preferred model to get us to 2050.
From AEMO's The Australian Energy Market Operator's LinkedIn page 1 year ago, AEMO has today become a signatory to Equal by 30, a global initiative committed to accelerating the participation of women in the clean energy sector and closing the gender gap by 2030. We join with the Australian Energy Market Commission and the Australian Energy Regulator as signatories to this important initiative. At AEMO, we strive to be an inclusive organisation where our diversity represents the communities that we serve, and everyone has a strong sense of belonging, irrespective of cultural background, age, gender, religion, sexual orientation, carer status, or disability, CEO Daniel Westerman said. Let's return to the nuclear hearings for a second. While Matt Keane may not be a diversity hire, he certainly isn't making any friends under a potential coalition government. Expressing views like this on a nuclear power industry in response to questioning from Jared Rennick.
Well, I'm more than happy for the private sector to come in on the condition that they don't then become a conga line of rent-seeking parasites, which is what we've got in terms of all the subsidies from the government. And I just touched on one this morning with the contracts for difference. We've got the CEFC. And I mean, yet again, if renewables are cheaper, why do you have to use the government bank and not a private bank? We've got ARENA, we've got the Snowy Hydro project, we've got lithium charges, car battery charges are being subsidised. We've got a whole raft of subsidies being given to the private sector. And this is my problem with the hypocrisy of the neoliberal ideology of let's privatise everything, because what we've seen in the last 20 years is that they've eventually had to go back to the government cap in hand asking for more subsidies. So by all means, I'm happy for the private sector to be involved, but they've got to do it standing on their own two feet.
Well, Senator, can I say there's no bigger rent-seeking parasite than the nuclear industry? That's exactly what they're coming to the people of Australia with a handout for.
Apparently, the head of the Climate Change Authority, Matt Keane's current role, only attracts an annual salary of about $60,000. Back in the energy planning and regulation hearing, we have a Tony Wood from the Grattan Institute. Now, Tony Wood's been around long enough that he's had plenty of reports and plenty of writing espousing the potentials for wind and solar to lower the cost of everything. But I don't know, is Tony changing his tune these days? Has reality caught up with him? You be the judge.
In our assessment, what broadly happens, Senator, is that whilst wind and solar are low cost, marginal cost to produce, very low, the system costs aren't that much different. Because the cost of the transmission and the backup pretty well offsets the lower generation costs. Yeah.
Okay, I know this segment has dragged on a bit, but I've saved the best for last. A Dorothy Dixer is a question asked by a friendly party in a political context, often prearranged, so that the response can be framed either to disparage your opponents or support your arguments. It's also used to waste time, allowing the respondent to run out the clock with a lengthy and entirely useless rambling answer. Here, we have Rod Campbell from the Australia Institute, who is clearly asked a Dorothy Dixer by the chair of the hearing, Labor's Dan Repicioli. Unfortunately for Rod and Dan, but entirely hilarious for us, the result is what I call a spectacular backfire. Enjoy.
Matt Saunders from the Australian Institute says that the increased use of renewables in supplying electricity is not the cause of higher retail electricity prices, and it is clear that more renewables will lead to lower prices. Could the Institute please expand on this, on these comments?
So, in the time we have available, what most directly affects retail electricity prices in Australia is retailers. Retailers and distribution of energy makes up the bulk of electricity prices paid by households. To the extent that increasing supply of electricity in the wholesale market pushes down retail prices, it's fairly it seems that increasing renewable supply, or increasing any kind of supply, assuming that it's competitive within the market, will help to, as they say, apply downward pressure on prices. But there's a lot of there's a lot more to the energy price sausage than just wholesale market prices.
I've shortened that explanation to the most relevant points.
As they say, the energy price sausage.
The work hasn't been done yet. You haven't done the work. Make the case. Do the work. Do the work. Do the work. You haven't done the work. And do the work. Do that work.
In case you missed it, Simon Holmes at Court appeared on a panel debate recorded, and it's on YouTube, courtesy of the Centre for Independent Studies. He debated Aidan Morrison, and the event was moderated by Chris Kiever, the well-known medical doctor who is also one of the world's most high-profile nuclear advocates. The section you heard at the start there was obviously clipped out of the conversation. Holmes at Court saying, do the work. He's referencing that nobody's come up with a cost yet for the nuclear proposal. And that's fair enough. But what is Holmes at Court's fallback position? And has he done the work? Well, Aidan basically asked him that. Here it is.
We do have a plan for the next 25 years. And this plan is reevaluated every 2 years.
What's it called?
It's called the Integrated System Plan.
Now, everybody who's paying any attention knows that AMO's plan does not specify what the total system cost is. You have to go digging for it. And when you do go digging for it, you find that it's a very big number in the $600 billion or so. And that leaves out basically all the transmission and infrastructure spending up to 2030. And it leaves out a whole bunch of other costs that are supposed to fall on consumers. And the problem with that strategy of leaving out the costs that are meant to fall on consumers is that the model that AMO uses depends on these devices, the batteries, solar panels, even electric vehicles, highly coordinated as support services for the greater network. And the greater network will not survive without these devices. So it is only fair to include those devices in the cost of this plan. Here's Aidan responding to Simon Holmes at Court, explaining exactly that point.
Then I think it's essential that we do turn a critical eye to the models. And I think if the challenge is to find fatal flaws in them, I'm happy to name one or two. And in particular, in the Integrated System Plan, the assumption that we will double that growth rate, not like 1 gigawatt of reactor worth of renewable energy, but two, that assumption that will occur very quickly and be sustained for the next 10 or 15 years, is driven by policy constraints that are imposed on the model. It's not a trajectory that is driven by natural headwinds or what's been achieved before. And so that's one, I think, fatal flaw. But the other one that I think is really easy is the assumption that we don't include the costs in that model for critical enabling parts, things that are indispensable to the system, such as the large amounts of storage from consumer energy resources and the assumption that consumers will shift everything from charging their EVs, buy a lot of EVs to start with, but shift their consumption so we can basically flex our consumption to match the sunshine and have huge peak in consumption during the middle of the day, which is not the case. And so there's some huge assumptions that I would say are just critical.
Holmes at Court responds to that perfectly reasonable argument with blah, 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 batteries.
I mean, too much energy just means that you've got super cheap energy in the middle of the day. And these batteries are actually being paid to charge in the middle of the day, and they're discharging in the evening.
To be honest, I'm not sure why Holmes at Court gets such airtime in this debate, and I'm only using this opportunity to point out that his arguments that he's presenting are basically the talking points of the renewables lobby. And it seems to me that he's not the kind of guy who would be downstream of those discussions. He's upstream of those discussions. He's creating these talking points. And I can't help but wonder what sort of WhatsApp chat groups he's in. I'm in a few with some interesting people, and we have great chats. But I don't think it'd go so well in those other chat groups if you opposed Holmes at Court's point of view. Here's Aidan again making a similar point to before, that the missing costs in the Integrated System Plan makes it incredibly flawed, and it's not to be used.
You just need to map out properly the system that increases it all the way far enough to actually solve the problem. And I think that that's not yet been done in the Integrated System Plan, because an enormous fraction, I think it's in the order of 100 or so gigawatt hours. I could check that. It might be 70 or something like that. Is from batteries that model does not cost, which are the batteries that they assume the household will buy.
A perfect example of Holmes are caught not understanding the problem, or maybe he does, and he just doesn't want to admit it, is his flippant dismissal of the concept of total system costs. In his own words, here it is.
The full system cost thing is an absolute red herring that you've introduced to the debate to confuse people on this, but it is a key source of your confusion on the integrated system plan. And please, let's sit down and have someone explain it to you in detail.
One common definition of irony goes like this. An event that seems deliberately contrary to what one expects and is often wryly amusing as a result. The irony on display here is that when Aidan Morrison, using Twitter, pointed out that Holmes Accord was wrong about his understanding of the ISP, Holmes Accord blocked Aidan on Twitter, the social media equivalent of a throwing your toys out of the cot.
A fucking goat outside.
It's just a goat.
No, it's a fucking goat.
Chris Bowen was interviewed by Laura Jays on Sky News in the aftermath of the so-called energy crisis in New South Wales last week. So he's a perfect candidate for the goat this episode.
Can we talk about price and reliability for a moment? Because at the moment, particularly in New South Wales and the East Coast, people want to know if they're going to be able to keep the lights on and how much they're going to pay for it. People have been told as well in New South Wales to turn off appliances during peak hours. Is this what we can come to expect as the new normal?
No. What we saw yesterday in New South Wales...
On the morning of the 27th of November, AEMO had issued a forecast LOR3 notice. That means they predicted that a bit later in the afternoon, from 3:30 in the afternoon to 5 o'clock, that they would be short 87 megawatts of electricity. And now this is after they've engaged all their reserve trading schemes and demand management schemes, and after all that, and they think they're still going to be short, they have to issue a forecast LOR3 that there may be a lack of power.
Well, something that does happen from time to time in our energy grid, which is very hot conditions, which obviously under any circumstances sees electricity use go up, and quite rightly. And then we had 5 units of fossil fuels out of action, 3 of which we knew about, 2 of which were breakdowns at very short notice, and that did put pressure on the grid.
According to farmonline.com.au, a low-pressure trough sitting over Australia's eastern inland was feeding a warm air mass towards eastern New South Wales, and the urban heat island effect combined with the fern effect allowed the Sydney Basin to become warmer than surrounding areas of central eastern New South Wales. Sydney Airport had warmed to 38 degrees at 12:15 p.m. Now, I had to look up what the fern effect is, and it turns out this is basically the Australian Chinook. As the air travels from inland towards the coast, it hits the range west of Sydney, and as it is forced over the range into higher elevation with less atmospheric pressure, it expands. As a result, the air mass cools and releases water as rainfall, becoming cold, dry air on the top of the mountain. The now dry air mass continues down the lee side of the range, and the opposite occurs. The dry air is compressed and becomes warmer as it gets closer to sea level at the rate of 1 degree C per 100 metres change in elevation. So there you go. A little bit of weather trivia, the fern effect.
But AEMO managed it well. They instituted all the various weapons they have at their disposal, and we had enough energy to get through the afternoon and evening. But things were tighter than usual, and hence the Premier suggested that if electricity use wasn't absolutely essential in that sort of 3 to 8 o'clock period, then maybe put it off until later or do it earlier, which is not the first time that has been suggested.
Mr. Bowen is absolutely correct. It is not the first time that it's been suggested we stop using dishwashers to preserve the integrity of the electricity system. Here's former Greens leader Richard Di Natale on Sky News in 2019 following actual blackouts caused by lack of supply on a hot January day in Melbourne.
We have to do this. And look, you know, we talk
about nuclear?
not using a dishwasher for a couple of hours. We're facing an existential threat as a species. Can you imagine the sacrifices that people made during wartime being told, well, sorry, we're not prepared to make a sacrifice that means for 2 hours during the day we can't use a dishwasher. That, I mean, please spare me.
Has anybody else noticed that when Greens say something, it's only a few years later that the Labor Party says exactly the same thing. In 2019, at the time of these blackouts in Melbourne, the CEO of the market operator was Audrey Zibelman. Here's what she said on the 7:30 report.
Suddenly, during that 1 hour that we ended up having to load shed, the wind dropped unexpectedly to 350 megawatts. And so had we not lost the wind during that hour, we would not have had to be in the load shed.
This is about, you know, what I've been saying for some time, Laura, that the biggest threat to reliability in our energy system is coal-fired power stations, which aren't getting any younger. And like all of us, as they get older, they get that little bit less reliable every day.
Yeah, they are unreliable. They've been quite unreliable for quite some time.
Hey, Laura, ease up on the coal-fired power stations, mate. They're not that bad.
AEMO has been warning about that. We get regular updates where they say, well, the reliability going into summer months because of these ageing coal-fired systems, coal-powered systems, well, that's just the way it is. But we have known that for quite some time. You have known that as you put this energy system together. So can we expect demand management and essentially energy rationing to be part of this government's plan? It has to be, doesn't it?
Well, no.
Well, yes. Bowen's plan, Albo's plan, the integrated system plan, which is not integrated, doesn't cover the whole system and isn't really a plan, it requires demand-side participation as one of its major inputs. It's a feature, not a bug.
I mean, there are methods and weapons that AEMO has always had at its disposal, which it has used under governments of all persuasions, like a thing called the RERT, which is where big industrial users who sign up for that program, who know that they're part of that program, can turn down their energy use as part of that arrangement that they have with AEMO, big aluminium smelters and things like that do that.
The problem with this demand management, demand-side participation strategy is this. Traditionally, demand management was limited to very few large users on very few occasions. The Bowen AEMO plan for a high renewables grid relies on demand management across the entire electricity consumer base, where instances of electricity rationing change from very few, very rare to very many, very common. This is a significant change in the paradigm. Consumers typically pay less for a reduced quality of service. We are not only paying more for reduced quality of service, we are expected to use it less.
And government bodies also reduce their energy need in circumstances like that. That is not what that's not what I would call, you know, widespread demand measurement or measures, as you put them. But it is part of the management that AEMO has always had and will continue to have that will be put into place on those unusual circumstances where things are a bit tighter than normal. But, you know, last summer we had people... Ted O'Brien said there were going to be blackouts all last summer. There were no blackouts last summer caused by a lack of energy. He jumps on any warning or any action by AEMO and says, look, the blackouts are coming. He's predicted 10 out of the last zero blackouts.
I've got to give Chris Bowen points for that. That's not a bad retort.
But it's AEMO saying it, right?
Blackouts.
AEMO is
doing their job. No, that's not what AEMO is doing, with respect, Laura. What AEMO is doing is saying they're issuing notices, as they do, lack of reserve notices. They issued notices yesterday. There's a lack of reserve one for New South Wales today, which is the lowest form of notice. In the last quarter of the Morrison government, they issued 36 lack of reserve notices. In the second last quarter, they issued 55. Yeah. This is not, you know, an extreme or unusual circumstance. It is part of managing our grid.
Since Chris Bowen's mentioned the statistics of market notices, let's go back to Q1 2024, 75 market notices. Q2 2024, 65 market notices. Q3 2024, only 35 market notices. These statistics are all available in the NEM's Lack of Reserve Framework quarterly reports.
Now, to your point, Laura, though, about the energy system, yes, we're seeing coal-fired power being very unreliable. That means we need to bring on the new investment. Figures I'm releasing today show that this year is a record year, biggest ever on record for renewable energy investment. Yeah. We've seen more investment in the last quarter than we did in all of last year.
Well, that's a bold claim, and so I'm forced to go to the source, which I expect is probably the Clean Energy Council's Renewable Projects Quarterly Report. And the most recent one being Q3 2024 says that projects achieving financial commitment reached $3.3 billion in Q3 2024. This was primarily due to Queensland's Lotus Creek Wind Farm with a capital value of $1.3 billion. Now, Lotus Creek Wind Farm, if I Google that, I'll find that CS Energy, one of Queensland's state-owned corporations, purchased the Lotus Creek Wind Farm. And for $1.3 billion, I thought it'd be a bit of a whopper of a wind farm, but it's not. It's 285 megawatts. Now, that I'm like, well, what is that in $1 million per megawatt or in $1,000 per kilowatt? And it's about $4.5 million per megawatt of installed capacity. For those listeners familiar with my strategy in these situations, I like to check the facts against, you know, what's been told to us in the past. And one of the most obvious places to look for claims of the capital cost of projects is, of course, the CSIRO's GenCost project, of which the most recent one, the 2023/24 version, on page 28, we have figure 2-1 under the heading Current Generation Technology Capital Costs. And I'll read the heading of this chart. Figure 2-1 provides a comparison of current cost estimates for electricity generation technologies with those from previous years. And if we look at this chart's statement of costs for onshore wind, it shows about $2.5 million per megawatt. That's a whole $2 million per megawatt less than the Lotus Creek Wind Farm. The CSIRO couldn't be that far out with their estimates, surely. Does anybody actually check these things? I don't know. Or is it just me? I'm going to have to skip through this next section of the interview a bit because Chris Bowen makes, you know, plenty of claims. And if I fact-checked every single thing he did and said, we'd be here all day. So let's get through it.
We've got a pipeline of investment which is equal in size to 2/3 of our national energy market. So the new investment is coming. It took our government to get the circumstances in place to see that investment. But after 10 years of denial and delay, I mean, we saw coal-fired power leave the grid under the last government, not enough new power come on. They saw 4 gigawatts of dispatchable power leave and 1 gigawatt come on. We're fixing that. But yes, it has meant that from time to time, particular markets like New South Wales yesterday have been a bit tighter than usual.
In the interest of speeding things up a bit, some artistic license there from the Baseload podcast.
Well, that's going to be happening more and more into the future, isn't it? And yes, I accept, you know, the last 10 years you weren't in power, but when you came to power, you knew what the situation was. And how is your plan going to make the electricity grid more reliable and cheaper when we're talking about 80% renewables in the system by 2030? I mean, the only reason we've got the power on at the moment, the only reliable system that you can call on is coal. You can't tell me when the wind's going to blow and the sun's going to shine.
Yeah. Well, I can't tell you when the rain's going to fall either, Laura, but we drink water every day.
But that's what goes to the whole reliability issue, doesn't it?
You know, I hate these false analogies. If you're going to have an analogy, at least make it worthwhile and make it applicable. Of course, the strategy is deliberate. Who can forget the... you know, emissions reduction is like your vote. Every bit counts, except that, of course, China has a hell of a lot more votes than we do here in Australia. The analogy Mr. Bowen's using there where, you know, it rains, so we store it so we can drink water whenever we want, is great, except we don't drink water continuously. We don't live in it. We're not fish. We drink it when we need it. It's on demand. Electricity would also be nice if it was available on demand, although that seems to be increasingly wishful thinking.
It does, and that's why we're going to build, and we are building, the transmission and the storage, and backed by gas peaking when necessary, to ensure a reliable system. But here's the thing. The least reliable part of our energy grid at the moment is coal-fired power. That's just a statement of fact. There hasn't been a day in the last 18 months when we haven't had a breakdown in a coal-fired power station.
Now, I don't have the time to fact-check the statement that, you know, every single day there's been a coal-fired power station breakdown. I assume he's referring to ongoing outages, for example, at the Callide C4 and C3 in Queensland. But, you know, at this stage, pretty much everything Mr. Bowen says about electricity is suspect. So I don't believe it. If anyone's willing to prove me wrong, go ahead.
Expected outages, that's maintenance, closing down, that's different. We know about them. We factor them in. We had three of those yesterday in New South Wales, getting ready for summer, making sure that the plants were up to scratch. Perfectly fine. Mm. We also, on top of that, had two that just broke down. Now, that means that you've got, so that means you're right. We've got to get more investment on earlier. That's exactly what we're doing. That's what our capacity investment scheme, which the previous government promised, by the way, but they never delivered. They also had a thing called UNGI, Underwriting New Generation Investment, which actually should have stood for, unfortunately, no generation involved, because it never delivered a watt. I mean, not a kilowatt, not a watt, not a megawatt, nothing, Angus Taylor's scheme.
Fact check true. This is unfortunate reality, but the previous government did start Snowy Hydro 2.0. That's going well.
In contrast, our scheme is delivering 32 gigawatts of renewable dispatchable energy.
Sure.
No, it's not delivering renewable dispatchable electricity at all. It's delivering subsidised renewables, which is pushing the price of everything up. And it's certainly not dispatchable. What did Mr. Bowen say just a minute or two ago in this interview?
And backed by gas peaking when necessary to ensure a reliable system.
Still not enough right now, isn't it? So my issue with this, Minister, is that, you know, we talk about reliable and cheaper power, and that coming from a main source of renewables, wind and solar. And that's, under your plan, going to be 82% by 2030. It is not cheaper and more reliable right now because you don't have the battery storage to back it up. And it was underestimated, the gas capacity that was required, was it not?
No, I don't agree with that. I mean, gas capacity, look at the ISP, it's the most detailed energy plan of any country anywhere in the world.
We do have a plan for the next 25 years, and this plan is re-evaluated every 2 years.
What's it called?
It's called the Integrated System Plan.
So the really good news is that the Australian Energy Market Operator, the operator, the experts who actually run the system, have done detailed costings to answer that precise question.
Well, hang on, you know, you didn't include it, but you didn't include it in the capacity investment scheme when the Energy Security Board recommended you should do in 2022.
Well, we're dealing with a different set of circumstances. The previous government promised a capacity investment scheme, couldn't deliver one, and I've delivered one. But the economics of gas and renewables are very different. The economics of gas is very different to the economics of renewables.
Indeed, renewables don't exist without subsidies.
Now, if you look at the ISP, the point I was making is that it calls and suggests and indicates that we need more gas capacity but less gas dispatch, i.e. more to call on when necessary, but you're going to need it less and less. That's appropriate.
So to clarify Mr. Bowen's position here, he expects we're going to need a lot more capacity of gas turbines, which means pipelines, which means gas supply, but we're going to use it a lot less, and this will be cheaper.
That's very different to renewables, which are going to be operating all the time, but you need the batteries.
Now we have wind and solar are going to be operating all the time, but they need batteries. That sounds like a contradiction to me.
Now we've got a lot of batteries under construction. Yep. Our capacity investment scheme supports batteries. And in fact, Laura, to your point about reliability, what the chief executive of AEMO told me yesterday was that batteries were essential for getting New South Wales through yesterday, that batteries played a very big role yesterday.
While I was putting this segment together, I heard that claim, and so I had to go and fact check for myself. So I went and got the NemWeb data, downloaded it, and I ended up with this post on Twitter with a couple of cool graphics. So from NemWeb data, we can see that New South Wales batteries did indeed provide a peak combined output of 200 megawatts during some critical periods. Fact check true. However, the battery output was not enough to prevent market price soaring to the cap, 17,500. And when we look closer, we can identify the total combined output of batteries over the 24-hour period was 365 megawatt hours. That's not much. While the total combined consumption was 795 megawatt hours. They consumed about double of what they put into the grid. Most of the battery charging was during the 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. window, where the average price, wholesale price, was $77 a megawatt hour, and the primary generation source was New South Wales coal. Do batteries reduce wholesale prices? This week was an ideal time to see some evidence of that.
Now, we have more coming on. You know, the Waratah battery, big ones, are coming on. They're coming on over the next year or so. But, of course, that means we've got to keep our foot on the accelerator and keep the task. Now, the alternative is to slow down, stop all that investment and wait for nuclear in the 2040s. I'm not sure how that helps us in the 2030s. On the contrary, it makes the situation less reliable in the 2030s.
That statement on reliability is only true if you allow the coal-fired power stations to rust away and turn off. So I suspect that we won't be turning any coal-fired power stations off in 2027. I think we'll be going a bit longer than that.
Yeah, that's right. We have a less reliable system until...
And if, well, if and we wait, if we wait, if we sit, if we, if,
but we have an unreliable system now, don't we, Minister? Because the transition has been messy. Let's put it down to that. Essentially, we've been gaslit to think that our energy system is reliable and cheaper. I can't see any evidence of that.
Well, yesterday you saw the biggest reduction in energy prices in Australian history in the ABS statistics. Today you've seen the Australian energy market. Today you've seen the Australian Energy Market Commission put out its report showing that renewable energy will reduce energy prices over the next 10 years by 13% and making the point we have to keep going on that journey.
So two points here. The claim that electricity prices are lower now than they were a while back is completely untrue. Mr. Bowen is, of course, including government rebates and handouts and all the rest of it in his calculation. The truth of the matter is shown in the RBA's data, which shows that electricity prices are, you know, about the same as they were 12 months ago, even if they are marginally changing around. The second thing Mr. Bowen mentioned was the Australian Energy Market Commission's Retail Price Trends Report, which does claim that more renewables will lower the prices, but they provide scant evidence of that, and the entire report is premised on the integrated system plan, of which all the costs are missing. So that prompted me to write another Twitter post, which I do occasionally, and it goes like this. If you want to understand the underlying changes in the cost of a washing machine, a car, plastic spoons, food, anything, you look at the supply chain components. It's the same for electricity. Every organisation and bureaucracy involved with or commenting on our electricity system does this, and so should us normies. Cost of generation is reflected in the wholesale cost. Getting the electricity from generators to customers is the network costs. Retailers have overheads, and there are environmental costs across the chain. This latest AEMC embarrassment is no different. The question you should all be asking yourselves, and the media should be asking every bureaucrat and commentator, is this. Which part of the supply chain do renewables make cheaper? End rant. The report itself has a page which is, the whole thing's laid out like a set of PowerPoint slides. So on slide 35, the comment across the top is, wholesale prices are projected to fall initially, but rise towards the end of the horizon as demand increases and supply conditions tighten. And the chart they have there is in cents per kilowatt hour, and they're showing in 2025, wholesale volume weighted average wholesale costs in 2025 numbers are about 11.5 cents. Now they're saying that those prices are projected to fall by about 10% by 2034, which is 10% of 11 cents is about 1.1 cents. This is $10 a megawatt hour. It's absolutely ridiculous what these people are saying. They've got no idea. And when you go through the report looking for specifics, say, for example, gas generation, the only way they treat that by adding in a volatility fudge factor. They don't even mention the price of gas. It's crazy. We're going to wrap up the Bowen interview there. It does continue on for a bit longer, but it's mostly just Laura Jay's trying to pin Chris Bowen down on a commitment to reducing electricity prices, and Bowen's far too wily to be caught in a promise he can't keep, except for the last time. This final segment continues with the assistance of one George Carlin.
Okay.
We can talk about energy prices and those two reports, if you like.
So yeah, let's talk about those reports, because you promised that retail electricity bills, and let's talk retail, because that's what people care about, would fall by $275 by now, essentially, by the end of this year, beginning of next year. They've gone up. So when will those prices actually come down? If you say they've fallen 5%, we're talking about a rise of 21% since you made that promise.
So what, we're
still 16% worse off. That's a long way from a $275 reduction on our bills, wouldn't you agree?
I said 35%, Laura, not 5%. 35% was the figures that the ABS put out yesterday.
Okay, so
the biggest fall in energy prices in Australian history.
Yeah, but is that retail?
I have a very low tolerance level for stupid bullshit.
Yeah, that's the prices that Australians pay. That's the impact of government policies, rebates, state and federal, as well as getting on with the job.
But we've got to remove rebates from that, because that's not what you promised when you were promising the $275. Taxpayers are still paying for that.
No, but Australians... But Australians have received the rebates, Laura.
Okay, I mean, but if you remove
Australians are receiving them.
If you remove how much are electricity prices really coming down by?
Well, going forward, what you're seeing is the impact, and that's where the Australian Energy Market Commission's report comes in. If you've had a chance to have a look at that, it shows very clearly the impact of our policies, of the renewables that we will bring into the system. They confirm renewables are the cheapest form of energy available to Australians, indeed to anyone, really, but particularly Australians at the moment with our very strong renewable resources, which are the envy of the world. We would be mad. It would be a disaster for emissions, for reliability and for prices to pause that renewable investment and wait for nuclear to come on in the late 2030s or 2040s.
Chris Uhlman, welcome to the Baseload Podcast.
Ben, lovely to be here.
Well, thanks so much for joining me. And I must have to say congratulations on your documentary, The True Cost of Net Zero. I'm extremely chuffed to have been able to contribute. And if I had a hat that said so, I'd actually wear it every day.
Well, that's fantastic. And thanks to you and people like you who are actually experts in this field that we were able to try and walk through what is, as you know, extremely complex, even if you're an electrical engineer like yourself, but it is mind-blowingly complicated for the general public. And that's essentially what we try to set out to do, is to explain to people why their electricity bills are going to go up, not down.
Yeah, you're right on it being complex. And even me, I've got a technical background in the physical side of it, but the market side of it is, you know, it's a whole other career, basically. It's crazy how difficult it is to understand.
Yeah, look, we're all used to the fact that we flick the switch and the lights come on, okay? And then we get told certain things about it by our political leaders. And the one message we all got loud and clear before the last election was that, you know, renewable energy, wind and solar energy is greener and it's cheaper. In fact, the government put a price on it. But by now, we should all at retail level have been getting a $275 price cut. Well, the exact opposite has happened. We've got a $300 government subsidy now, which the government appears to think is delivering on that promise. Well, it's 180 degrees from what they actually promised. And it's hard to see how prices can do anything but rise from now on. And you know why better than anyone.
Yeah, thanks. So it's been a hard slog trying to get to the bottom of it. And it's even someone, I think even Einstein might have said, if you understand it, then you should be able to explain it simply. And I'll tell you what, it takes a lot of effort to try and get to there. And even then, most times I fail. So yeah, the documentary does a great job. The graphics and the way it's laid out. I'm really pleased to see it come out there. Now I've seen a variety of feedback online, from jeering to cheering, and some outright lunatics, to be honest. In your circles, I guess I'm talking about fellow journalists, what range of feedback have you seen? Has anyone come up to you and said great work or otherwise?
Yeah, some have said great work and others have said otherwise. And it's what I expect nowadays, because the media is so polarised, they're essentially cheering for different teams. And what I don't get from some of those people who are actually friends of mine is that their minds are completely closed to anything but wind and solar. And this is what gets me, Ben, about the transition that we're in. It seems to me that in Australia in particular, we are completely trapped by a particular lobby, and that particular lobby is the wind and solar lobby. It is extremely powerful. But what really gets me about that lobby is that it's ruled out every single exit pathway. So, you know, any way that might assist us in getting to this target, which they're the ones who are championing it. So carbon capture and storage can't do that. Nuclear power can't do that. Coal, of course, could never do that. The thing that really gets me is that they actually have been advocating against gas. And when you look at what the energy market operator has said, which is that we'll need 15 gigawatts of gas from now until 2050 and beyond, they've been cheering against the only technology that can actually keep the lights on the system that they want. So it I'm pretty certain that most of the people who've been pushing for this have no idea at all about the limitations of their own technology or about how it could possibly work with the system that we have.
My dad, he's getting pretty old, and he likes one of his favourite sayings when he's talking about his annoying children is that they can have selective hearing. And I'd apply the same comment to the vast population that inhabits the renewables lobby that we're talking about, because they, on one hand, they'll hold up the ISP and Chris Bowen, et cetera, have done all this, and the renewables lobby do all this, and they hold up this integrated system plan via the planner, and yet they don't seem to actually understand it or even dig into what it's meant to say. And what you said is correct, that they're talking about a gas backbone, I think is the way you described it, and Daniel Westerman agreed with you.
Yeah, look, and he would describe it as a backup, right? But, you know, it's 15 gigawatts, and you and I both know, and you much better than me, that's not a little bit of gas, right?
That's enough gas
for 15 million households. So essentially all we've done, what gets me about this stuff, mate, is that all we did, if you look at that documentary, is we go to the energy market operator, we say to him, Daniel Westerman, tell us what's in your plan. And it's Daniel Westerman that says, we've got a lot of gas in our plan, and by the way, we don't have enough gas, and we'd really, really, really like some more gas. One of the big criticisms that we've got is that we went looking for gas and couldn't find any on the East Coast. It's mostly being exported from Queensland, and its supply is being cut off in Victoria and New South Wales. We get accused of being sort of, you know, in favour of the gas lobby. All we're trying to do is work out how this system adds up. I don't believe that it adds up with the amount of gas that they've got. I think, Ben, you've done some work on this, that the amount of gas that they keep wanting to put in the system will rise over time. But this idea that it'll only run 5% of the time, I think that's nonsense.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's no chance of it working the way they say it's going to do. I think their model might be accurate in terms of how much stuff or physical stuff they need in the grid, but one of the problems that we've noticed and we've talked about a lot, you and I and other people as well, starting to notice that they don't really go into the effect on consumers of all this extra stuff and all the gas and, you know, the hydro and this massive overbuild of wind and solar and the batteries. You talked to some quite clever and experienced people in your travels for the documentary. I'm not putting myself in that bucket. I was thinking more like your American guys overseas. What their feedback was really interesting.
Yeah, and the other thing that we've done too, and I mean, unfortunately, at the moment, not unfortunately, because Sky paid for it, so good on Sky for paying for it. It'll come out from behind the paywall on Wednesday. I don't know where this goes to air, but essentially that's in 2 days' time from now. But behind the paywall, we decided we would actually put up quite a few of those interviews in full, because one of the things I expected along the way would people would say, oh, well, you've misrepresented them. They didn't really say all of that sort of stuff. We went to the United States in search of examples about what's going on, because in a lot of places they're doing similar things to what we're doing here. We spoke to Jim Robb, who's the head of the North America Electric Reliability Corporation. Now, its only job is to look at reliability, and he looks at the entire internet-connected grids in the United States. He oversees all of them. He's appointed by Congress, so this is a bipartisan appointment. This guy has no particular iron in the fire for any kind of technology. But what he has said is that while we've seen the rise of this particular technology, we've seen the energy reserve margins in the US fall and the likelihood of interruptions rise. And he said to us at one stage, we've been putting a lot of effort into the three legs on the stool, the one leg of the environmental leg, and quite reasonable given we're trying to cut carbon emissions. But we realise now it comes at affordability problems and reliability problems. And I believe, he said, we're going to have to get those back in balance. Michael Caravaggio works for EPRI, which is, you know, is a unique organisation which basically just researches electricity, has done for the last 50 years. Again, it's not pushing any particular cause, but the points that he made were really good. Is that, you know, having 5% of solar in your system is not a problem. It's a significant problem when you get 100% of your energy from solar. And what we see is as these technologies scale, their technical limitations start to come more and more into play. And Ben, you know, again, you are all over this stuff, and the stuff that you're doing, I think, is really, really important. We have to begin to educate people about what the limits of this kind of technology are, because the promises that have been made for it are way beyond what it can ever deliver.
The education part, you're right. So in reference to the stuff that I do, I've I've thought long and hard about this since I first became aware of the problem in my... I did a lot of fly-in, fly-out work, and I first joined the natural gas industry in Queensland in 2012 because I was sick of travelling for work. I'd spent 96 days at home in 2011, and I thought I need to go and get a more stable job here in Brisbane, and that was beautiful for 2 years, and then they stuck me on fly in, fly out, so I shot myself in the foot there. It's not a gas company unless it has a restructure every 6 months.
But look at the structure, you go on, mate. Sorry, you go on.
Yeah, so I was just going to say that I had no time to even think about this stuff. I didn't even realise it was a problem. I'd never heard of climate change. My head was in the sand as far as that goes. I had no idea. And then as coming up to, I think it was Scott Morrison's first election against Bill Shorten, and I heard a lot of stuff coming up on the news, and I was paying a bit more attention for some reason, and I started becoming aware of this renewables conversation, and I started researching it for myself, trying to answer my own questions, which is what I think is incumbent on every voting citizen to do, to make you. I went through this phase where I thought, shit, I need to make my vote count for something a bit more. I want it to be a well-researched and a quality vote. And I naively assumed I'd get to the bottom of it. And here I am, but you know, nearly 8 years later, and we're fighting this fight. So when you say about the education piece, in that I've bottomed out on myself, where I think the cost argument is very powerful, because that's one of the greatest myths. And the environment piece is also really interesting, because when you travelled the hills of North Queensland with Stephen Nowakowski, he seemed to really bring it home, and he's a great crusader for this argument. So, is there any extra stuff from Stephen's and your site visits up there, which didn't make it into the doco?
Oh, lots, mate. And so, you know, over time, we might be able to get some more of it out. And, you know, Stephen is an absolute warrior. And what Stephen is, again, from these people who came at us essentially saying that we're anti-saving the planet, that we're making an argument against climate change. Stephen is an absolute believer in that, and has been a Greens candidate and has spent his entire life. I mean, he's a proper Green, right? He's a Green who's trying to keep trees in the ground. And he got
he lives in Kuranda. He's a proper tree-hugging hippie. And I've spoken to him. He's happy to be described as that.
And when you drive around that part of the world with him, he will show you all of the different things, all of the, you know, the time and energy that he spent with other people getting the money together to basically start connecting forests by buying bits of land, you know, and the walkways that they put over highways so that animals, native animals, can actually get safely from one side to the other. This guy is serious about protecting the environment. The point that he makes, obviously, is, you know, it is that with climate change, the first thing you want to do is be keeping trees in the ground, right? This is carbon sinks, and yet we are clearing massive amounts of forests up there along the Great Dividing Range, and Stephen is having a huge effect. But I think that one of the things that maybe you don't give yourself enough credit for, and in terms of the way that our documentary is broken down, it was in trying to find a way to explain it to people. You were the one who I thought had the best take on that, and that was to break it into the different parts of the bill and then ask which bits will be driven up and which bits will be driven down. Well, you can explain that, because that's really the heart of this documentary.
Yeah, I think for me, that's how I've bottomed it out in my own mind, and I've tossed it around a few different ways, and this is the message that I'm trying to get out there, which is exactly that. So you've got a supply chain for supplying electricity. So how do renewables impact that supply chain? And as soon as you start talking in those terms, you can really clear away the really easy basic arguments, and you can get right to the nitty gritty. So for me, the easy ones are, you know, what's renewables impact on the transmission grid? Well, an extra 10,000 kilowatts is going to cost more, right?
Yep.
And so then we get into the retail and the environmental, and so what's the impact of more renewables on those? Well, it's either nothing or it's going to cost more. And then we get into the cost of the generation, and that's where I think the battle on cost will actually be won and lost in those details. And if we can talk about it enough and get the message out there, then I think, and I've said this before too, I think the Australian voter in a few years is going to be the most educated on energy in the world, because we'll have to be to get out of this hole.
Yeah, and the part of the bill that you're talking about is the wholesale part of the bill, right? It's the only part of the bill where wind and solar, when it's generating, could possibly push down the price of wholesale electricity. And it does when it's generating. But when we go back and look at the last quarter, for example, you know, and particularly that coal part from April to June, where wind and solar was really underperforming, it only set the wholesale price of electricity for 7% of the quarter. And when you think about it and look at the numbers, it will always only set the price of electricity for a real minority of the quarter, because yep. it's that last megawatt of demand that sets the price. And again, look at some of the critics of the stuff that we've done, mate. They still don't understand it's the highest cost of electricity that sets that last, if it's, that's the last megawatt, then that's what the price is. If it's $300, it's $300 for everyone. If it's $17,500, which is now the cap, that's what everyone gets. And, right. and you don't have to be generating at those sorts of prices or even well under that for a very long before the wholesale price across that quarter is genuinely pushed up.
Chris, I really commend your efforts in getting to the bottom of that, because that's some of those points you've made, like you said, people get hung up on those and have no idea, even though they've been around the industry for ages. So at the moment, I'm on a 4-day training, which is 2 days of seminars and 2 days of actually in-house workshops, high voltage design, commissioning and safety. One of the perks of working for a gas company is that they can afford to put you through some decent courses every now and then, which some other firms you can't say the same. Now, the very first talk this morning was a very experienced high voltage engineer. So there's a lot of good technical people out there, and when they're talking, I realize how much I don't know about the technical side, because you could, like, people write PhDs and they spend their whole career just on one tiny element, which might be a modeling or a harmonics or, you know, reactive power, something like that. So this guy was actually talking about some of the things that we don't talk about very often in technical senses, which is the challenges of inverters and what inverters do and what they can and can't do. And so he spent 5 minutes at the start talking about sustainability and climate change. Then he spent 40 minutes saying how bloody difficult it's going to be with inverters because they're so limited in what they can do. That kind of information is going to start seeping into the story more and more, I think, especially as Chris, you and your cronies, your journalists, actually start picking up on the message, on the information.
Oh, mate, well, I've got to say, as we said before, it's so polarised now that, in fact, you'll find a huge pushback from certain parts of the media against anything that we try and do and say. And I've been saying to a few people now, I feel like, you know, perhaps you, me, Stephen Wilson, a whole bunch of others now, they're like the 300 at Thermopylae, mate. We might hold up the Persians for a while, but I think they'll run us down. But eventually we may well win the war, because in the battle between politics and physics, mate, physics is undefeated. And the real issue that we have got with all of this is that there are too many activists, you know, people who are climate scientists but not actually engineers, too many politicians who know literally absolutely nothing about energy systems and the kind of change that they're trying to affect. Because again, once they're finished with the electricity system, by the way, they won't ever be if this is the pathway that they're going down, then they can try and unravel the rest of the 80%, which is, how do we make cement? How do we make steel? How do we make ammonia? And how do we make plastic? All of which have fossil fuel embedded in their industrial production. You just can't reinvent this stuff. And every time every time it gets hard, someone says, oh, green hydrogen.
I've written about green hydrogen, so I feel qualified to comment on this stupid thing. But even today, I was having a snack break with an engineer from Transgrid, and he's like, so what about hydrogen? Isn't that going to be something? And I'm like, no, it's really not. And I had to explain it to him from first principles, and he looked at me and he's like, huh, I didn't know that. I'm like, oh, come on, man, you're in the industry. Anyway, hey, Chris, you mentioned the polarization and people are stuck in their lane, really, I guess is one way of talking about the politicians. But you've been in the reporting on news stories for, it's rude to say you've been reporting on stories for a hell of a long time.
Since the last millennium, mate. Yes, just to say sometime in the last millennium.
Let's go a couple of decades. And do you remember your first energy story that you talked about, or is there a change in how how you see that it's unfolding in the media landscape?
Well, I can tell you, like, when I first heard of climate change, because Ros Kelly was the Environment Minister, she was also the Minister for Canberra, and I was the journalist working for the Canberra Times who was tasked with doing a feature on her before she went to what was then called the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. Remember that? And that was the first time I had ever heard about this thing called climate change, and that's where the kind of carbon-cutting journey begins, and all of these COPs, they're essentially numbered from that time.
Were you on board, or were you ambivalent, or were you sceptical?
I had no real idea, mate, and I was prepared to certainly listen to it. I remember it wasn't actually in that interview, but what I was really worried about was I had a 1969 Valiant, and at the same time they were talking about the fact that they were going to get rid of leaded petrol.
A charger?
And
I was, making, was it a charger?
It wasn't a charger, unfortunately. It wasn't that cool. Yeah. But I was just terrified because I thought, I can't afford a car that's, you know, unleaded petrol car. They're really expensive. I want to keep driving this. And that went ahead, of course. You know, there were great changes to the environment that were affected by some of these things. I don't deny any of that. But the other story that I really remember was that I go back to September 2016, and on Sunday, and I can't remember the exact date, I did a story saying that South Australia was the canary in the coal mine, that it had shut down its last coal-fired power plant. It was now trying to run this experiment on wind and solar, and we'd see what was happening. 3 days later, on the Wednesday, the lights went out. So I kind of doubled down on this. I blamed the wind and solar generators. And, mate, the response...
Did you win some friends out of that?
Oh, it was hysterical. I was working for the ABC for a start. And then what happened was we had literally, the ABC has got an onerous complaints system if you get on the wrong side of it. And the way to get on the wrong side of it is to say something that upsets the majority of the audience, which pitches to the left, basically. And so what happened was we had hundreds or more, maybe I think there was actually a couple of thousand in the end of complaints about the story that I did. What was really interesting was there were a number of them, and we're talking in the, like, several dozen. So a lot of them were clearly it was a campaign, you know, for a lot of them. But then there were
the pro forma, they had the template.
Yep. And then beyond the pro formas, though, were the people who'd spent an enormous amount of time and energy, and they were government-funded organisations that went through point by point saying, you said this, you left out that. Like any news story is going to be like that. You didn't include this, you didn't include that. And we ended up, and when I say we, myself and the bureau chief in Canberra, so I was working at a Parliament House in Canberra because I was the political editor, had to answer dozens and dozens of these really detailed complaints, and it tied me down for months. And at the same year, by the way, I'd done a story on China's power and influence, and had basically started to say $5.5 million worth of money from the Chinese Communist Party is washing through our political system. And at the end of the year, I remember saying to Gillian, look, I never thought the Chinese were going to kill me, but I actually thought that the environmentalists might. And it was then, by the way, I decided to make... Yeah, well, I thought, you know, there's not much future for me at the ABC if I can't report on this kind of stuff. But after that, I started paying a whole lot more attention to energy and started trying to educate myself as to what was going on.
And here you are with a good documentary. Has anyone flagged that? Are you going to get any awards for this? What sort of awards can you get for a documentary that bucks the narrative these days?
And therein lies the problem, Ben. I don't hold out hopes at all for getting a kind of award for this. The reward for me, and this is the thing, the show's called The Real Cost of Net Zero. It will be out from behind the sky paywall pretty soon. Is that all I want people to do is watch it with an open mind. And talk about it and share it with your families. Have a conversation and begin to understand what you understand, which is we are talking about the life support system for civilization. This is the most sophisticated and the most important piece of equipment that we have got. If this breaks, everything goes. You know, there will be nothing made in Australia. There will be no jobs, and we will become a really poor country if we get this wrong. And unfortunately, mate, at the moment, like the sign says, wrong way, go back. But there are very few people who, except people like yourself, Stephen Wilson, Aidan Morrison, Zoe Hilton, who can see it and are prepared to try and say something before we go too far down a track, which will be very hard to reverse on.
Indeed. So, Chris, that's a great place to sign off. I just want to let you know that what I do is sometimes I take one of those pithy sections of your paragraphs from The Australian or wherever it pops up, and I stick it on Twitter, and I'm like, Yulman gets it. And that's going to be the tagline from now on. So thanks for joining me today. You've been a great guest.
Mate, you take care.
Thank you, bye. You've been listening to the Baseload podcast. If you like the show, subscribe and tell your friends. Remember, the mailbox is open, thebaseloadpodcast@gmail.com.